This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Trot and Tick. My guest today is Keith Rosario, the tech blogger who briefly gave us psychandahack.com, a website that gave Malaysians the ability to check whether their personal data were compromised in what was the biggest ever data breach in the country. I wanted to find out what he thought the lessons were for him and us from this episode. It was an eventful end for you to 2017. How did you feel about the whole episode?
yeah, eventful. Very, yeah. Very eventful. How do I feel about the whole episode? I don't know, to be honest. I think it's all sort of faded into memory now, and people have moved on to the next big news story. Mm. So, I mean, to be honest, I don't feel anything about it anymore.
Did you feel like you were Batman? Or made to feel like, because you're not doing anything, like you're not taking justice into your own hand, but you were just made to seem that way.
Yeah, so I'm a big DC fan, I'm a big comic book fan, so I'm a true nerd, but I think Batman is taking it a bit too far. I just built a site because I thought people had a right to know and people should know, and you know, some people didn't quite like that. So yeah, but not Batman. I really don't think Batman is the right description. Yeah.
So what do you think is the story here? Did the media coverage get it right? Like, was the thing, what was the breach, the story itself? Was it the late discovery, or was how the regulators responded to it?
So I guess one of the things we should understand is that, you know, breaches are pretty common these days. They happen all the time. And some of that is just the price of living in the modern society, the price of living in the modern world. You know, we subscribe to so many different services that 5-10 years ago, we never even knew existed. Things like Uber and Foodpanda and, you know, the hundreds of forums that we go to, etc. And every time you subscribe to a new service, you give some of your information away, and one of those services, you know, every now and then loses that data. So breaches happen all the time. It doesn't mean they're okay. It doesn't mean that, you know, people shouldn't protect their data. But we should come to accept that, you know, it's part and parcel of everything we do in the modern society. The late discovery, that's also pretty common, as much as we think. So sometimes these discoveries happen years after the breach occurred, and we scramble back to figure out what was the actual incident that caused the breach. So I guess the breach itself and the late discovery, we can sort of put that aside. I guess that's pretty normal. I mean, we have to accept that, really. The response, I think, was a bit lacking. Today, basically, everybody's forgotten about it and moved on, like I said. Maybe we should have been a bit more proactive. And to be honest, this breach wasn't, let's say, not that big a deal. I know it's a bit counterintuitive, but yeah, so to think about it, right? So it's like people always fascinate on the number 46.2 million or whatever it is. That's all, okay, so everybody's impacted, yeah. And you lost your IC number, phone number, some sort of things as well. But, you know, the breach in and of itself didn't mean much. There's very little you can do with that information. If you lost, for example, your hospital records, that's a bit more sensitive. If you lost your bank records, it's a lot more sensitive. If you lost your email, that's a lot more sensitive. So in terms of the scale of things, this is not that high. But we should have used it sort of like a test run and of how things go. It impacted nearly every Malaysian, as far as I know. And we should have, you know, reached out to them and tell you, this is the data to be lost, you know, sorry about that. and then find some way to make people whole again. It wouldn't have been that hard. But I guess the current response has been just basically to let people know there's a breach and move on, that sort of thing.
Every Malaysian, you say, is impacted by this, even those without a mobile phone?
No. So if you didn't have a mobile phone account, you wouldn't have been impacted. For example, even if you have a mobile phone but it's a supplementary line to someone, you probably wouldn't have been impacted. That's another thing. So almost, but not everyone. Yeah.
Okay. And so because you say data breaches are so common, those that are reported, are those just the tip of the iceberg? There are many, our data might be compromised in an infinite number of ways, and we just don't know about it because it's not reported yet.
Yeah, it's how you have to answer that question, right? Because you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
but what you can know is that basically what we know is probably not all of it. So whether it's a tip of the iceberg or whether it's 80% or 90% of all the breaches out there, we probably will never know, I guess. So it's hard to know. But you know, for BFM listeners, I guess you, I'm guessing your main audience is now urban English speaking semi affluent person. You, this is not the only breach you're part of. Like, you're part of many many breaches already, and this is just one of them. So yeah, they happen all the time.
Yeah. So you say the information that was leaked from this is almost worthless. But I guess when we hear a story like this, the immediate concern is that people are going to empty out our bank accounts or, you know, run up huge telephone bills on our name, in our name. So what do hackers do with information like that is gotten from a leak like this?
Yeah. This is one of the challenges we have. So if someone, you know, calls you today and reads out to you your IC number, reads out to you your name and your address, and then tells you that they are Inspector so-and-so from this police station in, you know, Johor Bahru or something, and then you have to come down or they will come and find you. So these are the sort of phishing scams and the scams that they use. So if someone knows this information, they can use it against you to sort of fish for more information, to scam you, to maybe do some identity theft. So the way I think about it is that the breach itself is sort of like, you know, having high cholesterol, let's say. In and of itself, it's not really that big a deal. It's what you're afraid of is that high cholesterol translating into a heart attack somewhere down the road. So the breach itself, you know, the data in itself means more or less almost nothing. But that data can be used to perform identity theft or, you know, scamming you in the future. And that's what it is, basically.
So how would you go about trying to protect yourself against those scams? If someone were to call you and recite your IC number to you?
Yeah.
Ask for more information. Do you know about my parents? Do you know about where I went to school?
No. You can't ask. Let's say a bank wouldn't know that, right? So a bank calls you and tells you there's something, you know, Mr. So-and-so, I am from this bank and you have an account with us and, you know, some sort of thing. That leads up to more, you know, lies and scams further down the road. I guess if someone calls you like that, what you should do is you should take down their details and then tell them you call back and not call back the number that they give you, but go online and find the real number of that particular, you know, entity or organization. So someone says they're from the bank. Okay, so take down their name, take down their designation, take down their, you know, whatever contact details they have. But then go online and try to search for the actual bank's phone number and call the bank directly, if, you know, an out-of-band communication. If they tell you they're an inspector so-and-so from this police station, you say, okay, to take down the name, take the designation, put on the phone, and then go online or call your local police station and ask them for the phone number of that particular police station, that sort of thing. Because, you know, very seldom does the bank call you directly. Very seldom does a police station call you directly, that sort of thing. The police wanted to talk to you, they'd come and see you. they wouldn't call you, that sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned this, that this story seems to be forgotten. And you have written on your blog that many of us are suffering from breach fatigue. Is that a good thing? Is that a new normal? Is this just, as you mentioned, the price of living in a connected world, tech-connected world?
I wouldn't say it's a good thing. I think people should be responsible with the data that you give to them, and that responsibility cannot just vanish. But breach fatigue is... Well, whether it's good or bad, it's basically the rational thing you do. If you get bombarded with news every day of some entity somewhere losing hundreds of millions of account data, you can't be worrying about all of those things simultaneously. At some point, you have to say, well, you know, just accept it and move on. Breach fatigue actually comes from a study that they did. So there's two studies that I quote on the blog. It basically says that, you know, what is the impact of a breach on an organization? So the first study found that in terms of stock price, the organization suffers a very minor dip in stock price and then recovers. But then over the next 3 to 5 years, they sort of lose massively to the index that they're benchmarked against. But what they also found is that over time, that impact has reduced. I.e., if you were breached in 2014 and reported in 2014, the impact to your company, it was more than if you were breached in 2017. And I think that people have come to realize that, okay, breaches are normal. And they're not sort of holding companies too accountable for that, let's say, or they're not sort of losing their minds over it. What people look for is how the company responds to a breach, how the company goes about making the consumers or the subscribers whole again. You know, that's the important part. How people respond to the breach, that's the thing that people are measuring more nowadays. Doesn't mean that, you know, you can lose the data and just respond well, but at least you come to a realization that, okay, these things do occur, but, you know, how do we mitigate them? How do we respond to them?
So if I understand that study right, is that once a breach happened, the company doesn't suffer immediately, but they suffer down the road 2 or 3 or 5 years later.
And that was quite dated, that data. But basically what it was quite a massive percentage drop in terms of stock price over the next 3 to 5 years. It was quite massive, yeah.
So study explain why this happened? Was it a loss of trust in the brand or something like that?
That's a good point. I don't know. I don't know specifically why they mentioned it, but basically they do a full-blown study across all of these different industries and they find that commonality. Mm. The second study actually measured things along the lines of litigation. So if breach occurs, how many of these breaches actually result in litigation against them? And they also find that the amount of litigation, the percentage of litigation is also dropping over time. Why the impact is reducing or why the litigation is reducing, I guess, is people have come to realize it's normal.
I'm speaking today to tech blogger Keith Rosario of keithrosario.com. Next, I'll ask him about how to better protect our data going forward. Stay tuned on BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. My guest, Keith Rosario, was all over the headlines last year for the website he put up, psychandahack.com. How do you manage your risk then? Because almost doesn't make sense for us to withdraw, right? So do you just connect and just let everything out there? You sign up for the services and surrender all your personal information to benefit from the services? Or do you try to negotiate how much you want to review and, you know, manually tick off those do not share location, for example, for the protection of your security and privacy?
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess that's a it's a very detailed question. I guess that's on a case-by-case basis. So you got to look at the service that is being offered and the data that they're requesting. And you got to decide there and then, A, how much you want to share, B, whether this service is something you even want in the first place. So, for example, you may go and buy something from a shop somewhere and they offer you a $10 discount if you sign up for their loyalty program. And the cost of that $10, basically the loyalty program asks you for all this information and asks you for your, you know, IC number, your name, your address, sometimes even your income, et cetera, that sort of thing. I guess you got to make a case-by-case decision. Maybe you say, well, I'll forgo the $10 discount because I don't want to be part of your loyalty program. Thank you, but no thank you sort of thing. And it depends. So some services you absolutely need to, like a telco, for example, right? You can't live without a mobile phone today. And you know, you have to accept whatever they request from you. You have to do this. This is part of their regulations in place. The request for your IC number when you sign up for a telephone, et cetera, sign up a mobile account. It's a bit difficult to say I don't want a mobile account, right? That sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's all case by case. There is no, you know, one short answer for it.
Yeah. Would you know how does a false prepaid registration happen? Because they ask for your IC, and if you have to provide an IC, did the person give a forge of a false MyCard?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know. What I know is that it's an issue. And it continuously occurs, and the MCMC, I think, have fined telcos every year for the last 4 years, you know, up to millions of dollars in total for this. How the actual thing occurs, whether it's collusion between the dealer and the subscriber, or whether it's, you know, just some bad apples here and there, I'm not 100% sure. But we know it is an issue, and it continuously occurs.
Yeah. And so how valuable is our MyCard number really? Because you say in your blog that you're okay with it as a identification for identification purposes, but because it contains personal information, that is quite problematic.
Yeah, exactly. So the IC number, you know, the standard IC number that we have, the first 6 digits is your date of birth, right? Mm-hmm. And it's right down to the actual day where you're born. So it's your date of birth plus your age, it rolled into one. And then you've got your state of issuance, so whether you issue it in country or out country, which state in Malaysia. And then the last 4 digits, the last digit of the last 4 digits, whether it's odd or even determines the gender of the person, male or female. And so... when you give someone your IC number, by definition, you're giving them your age, your gender, and most probably even where you stay or where the IC was actually issued. That's a lot of information to be giving, you know, a guard at the at the local condominium or whatever. So if you want to use an IC number, it should be used as an identifier, just to identify you. You don't have to reveal this information. You just have to say, this is my, you know, IC number, and it uniquely identifies me in Malaysia as a Malaysian citizen, but it shouldn't give up all in one my age and my gender. Mm-hmm. So, for example, your bank account, it identifies your bank account within, you know, the millions of bank accounts that the bank has. But it doesn't really reveal anything. It doesn't reveal how much money there is in the account. It doesn't reveal who you are or what you are. It doesn't reveal your gender. It's just an account number. And so if you go to the online sort of marketplace forums, people just post their bank account number there and say, you want to buy this thing, just bank in, you know, whatever X dollars here, and then I'll ship you the product. And that's fine, because the only thing you can do with a bank account number is bank in money. So that's okay. Yeah. But if I did the same with an IC number, that's different, because the moment I publish my IC, I publish together with it my age and my gender and all the other things that I shouldn't want to publish. So there's a difference between identifier and authenticator, which I come to a bit. But if you want to really do an identifier, it should be completely, let's say, not anonymous, but it should be completely random sort of thing. So you shouldn't be able to glean extra information from an identifier. Now, we do, in some cases, need an identifier because, you know, we need to be able to uniquely identify citizens within the country, you know, manage bank accounts, manage tax records, manage all that stuff. So we need identifiers within the system. But those identifiers shouldn't leak out information about us.
So because this system is so entrenched and it's been going on for so long, yeah. And if you are put in charge today, how would you fix it?
Well, I really doubt we put in charge today. But,
is there an easy or convenient way of changing the way that MyCard number is structured?
People much smarter than me have thought about this longer than me.
Because this is not just...
I can just change the number, yeah.
Yeah, this is not just extracting information from the chip, right? It's the information is in the number itself.
Yeah, exactly. So the information is in the number itself. It doesn't have to be. Why would you want the information in the number? Credit card numbers don't reveal anything about you. Mm-hmm. Neither do bank account numbers. The identifier itself doesn't need to reveal information. And so if you sort of say, this is an identifier, it's meant to identify you, people should be comfortable sharing that identifier across, just like, you know, bank account numbers or that sort of thing. And I think a lot of countries who have identification systems, they're trying to move into the realm where these numbers are being more random as opposed to leaking information about you.
You've proposed one solution, which is the identity freeze. How would that work? Yeah.
So, in the US, you have this thing called a credit freeze, where you can freeze your credit. So think of it this way. So if you took a loan from a bank, let's say you took a loan from Maybank to buy a house, and you bought the house, and then you defaulted on that loan from Maybank. So you couldn't pay, and then Maybank took back the house. You end up on a blacklist, right? Mm-hmm. And then no bank in the country will ever give you a loan, regardless of how much the house is and regardless of how much loan you're taking. No bank in the country will give you a loan because you are on the blacklist. So effectively what we mean is the only people who don't have to worry about anyone stealing their identity and taking out loans are people on a blacklist. And the way they do that is they have these credit agencies and credit reporting systems. I forgot what the actual term is. But before a bank gives you a loan, before a lender gives you money, they can check your credit rating or your credit score. And based on that, they will decide whether or not to give you the loan. So you can, in the US, order a credit freeze. And that basically freezes your credit from anyone accessing it. And because you block access, no one will give you a loan. You know, just defeats the whole purpose, right? So you can freeze your credit, therefore you can be assured that no one's taking out credit cards in your name or loans in your name. So if you have something like that, an identity freeze, because in this country you also have prepaid registrations that are tied to your name, and then with the Evidence Act and multiple other laws, you could get in trouble with it. So you want to be able to say, well, you know, I'm happy with the mobile numbers that I have, I'm happy with the loans that I have, I'm happy with the credit cards that I have. I want to freeze my identity so that none of these corporations can, A, look into it, or B, give me credit for it, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Today, for example, you can get a free credit report from CTOS or whatever, and I think you can buy one more detailed report. But technically, it's your information, so you know why would anyone charge you for information about yourself?
Yeah.
But what I think we should do is have the ability to prevent people from taking out loans in our name, you know, and then give us that kind of control over our data. So your information might be leaking out there, but when somebody wants to collate that information and then start to use that to take out a loan in your name or take a credit card in your name or take a phone in your name, they're going to encounter some roadblocks because you've identified, you basically freeze your identity from happening.
And we should take data breaches seriously because you compare data breaches to diamonds. What's the comparison there?
Yeah. So, what are diamonds? So diamonds last forever. Although someone wrote to me and told me, well, technically they don't last forever. They actually decay into graphite.
That's a marketing line, isn't it? They last forever.
Yeah, that's a marketing. Well, they decay over billions of years. Or something like that. So it's fine. Little diamond nerds telling me stuff. So data breaches last forever as well. Once your data hits the internet, there is no containing it. There is no taking it off. Right. So this is something that is common for all digital data. If you know, that's the reason why movie piracy and music piracy and video game piracy are all such big deals. Because once someone rips a CD or rips a piece of music, rips a movie and puts it online, there is no containing it. There is no taking it out of the internet anymore. It's just there. It's over. Game over. It's forever going to be there. People are going to be able to forever access it. Mm-hmm. So if you, like me and like everybody else, are part of this data breach and the data breach is online and people have downloaded it already, there is no unbreaching yourself. There is no putting the genie back in the bottle or putting the cat back in the bag. You know, pick your choice of what you want to use it. There is nothing you can do. It's already there. There is no containment. What you should be focusing on is mitigation. Right. So that's one part of why they like diamonds. Diamonds also aren't as rare as you think. You know, that is marketing, basically. But you know, data breaches happen all the time. We discuss this, and they're going to happen. Well, they probably happen quite frequently, more frequently than you think. But not everyone's losing data, of course. Some people are very responsible with their data. They haven't lost data, but that sort of thing. And the last one is the interesting one, and that is that they're worth a lot more to you than to the criminals who steal them. So if you have a diamond ring, that diamond ring is worth a lot more to you than to the criminal who stole it or to the thief who stole it from you. And it's the same thing. So you may pay hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars to prevent your data from leaking out onto the internet. But once it's on the internet, it goes for like, you know, $5 a piece, $8 a piece sort of thing. Credit card data, you know, somewhere between $5 to $8, maybe slightly higher if it's a platinum card. This kind of data in the mobile phone breach, you know, it's being traded on freely. So you don't even have to pay money for it. Yeah. It's worth a lot more to you than it is to the criminal. In fact, to the criminals, they're worth nothing. It's basically being shared out freely on the internet. Yeah.
And in this case, they are straight out criminals. There's no nuance or to whatever that happened?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, straight up criminals. Of course, there's a nuance to it. Of course, it's not like they're murderers or something. We're still unsure how the data was lost, though. So, you know, we don't know. Another thing about data breaches is that most of the time, they're negligent as opposed to malicious. So someone accidentally lost the data or accidentally emailed the wrong person, accidentally left a thumb drive somewhere or accidentally left the laptop in the taxi sort of thing, as opposed to, you know, real hardcore malicious hackers getting into your system. And sometimes the negligence is from an IT perspective. So you forget to patch or you forget to update or you forget to secure a piece of software, or you forget that you left, you know, this database backup floating around on the internet sort of thing. So most of the time, they have a large negligence factor and a small malicious factor. It's very, very seldom that you have a breach that is fully, full-on malicious. You know, like the organization took all the steps to secure the data and the hacker still broke in anyway. It's very, very rare. You know, I don't know whether you would call it criminal or not. Obviously, someone stole this data and distributed it. So there is a criminal element, I guess, but there's a nuance there, of course. It's not like they killed anyone or they robbed the money, etc., this sort of thing.
So listening to you, I guess in terms of mitigation, the first step that any reasonable person would do is try to strengthen their password to everything, and two-step authenticators is what everyone seems to be doing at BFM. We've been mandated to do that. You know, everyone is forced to do it, and otherwise we'll lose all our emails. But then I'm starting to read about things that are saying how two-step authenticators are not entirely fail-proof too. So is that the strongest that we have, and that is still not enough?
So I'm so happy to hear that BFM mandated you to two-factor authenticator.
Yeah. And it's met with resistance, you know?
Yeah.
Because of how troublesome, I mean, it's an extra step. So there are many
types of factors. So basically, it's two-factor authentication, right? So the first factor is your username and password. You enter that into the system and you're logging in. And then there's a second factor. And that usually is either you have to rip up an app on your phone or you have some sort of dongle that gives you a six-digit number that you type in or an SMS is sent to you, etc., that sort of thing. So there's a second factor involved, or maybe if it's in even biometrics sort of thing. Of course, there is no such thing. There is no such thing as unhackable, right? So even if it was two-factor authentication, I'm sure there is some way to bypass it. And even if you installed all the antivirus in the world on a computer, there's still some way to compromise it. You know, there's no such thing as an unhackable solution, although some people seem to think it's possible. There's no such thing. So the only thing that two-factor authentication gives you, it is much, much, much harder if it was just than a single factor. So if you just had a username and a password, especially if you reuse your passwords all over around, which a lot of people do, then it's much easier to crack into your account. If you use two-factor authentication, regardless of what the second factor is, that is a much bigger step than just a single username and password. So it's really great. So if you want to take one thing, and we always tell people, the one thing you want to do is turn on two-factor for your primary email account, because that's the account that controls all the other accounts. If you lose access to Facebook, they can reset a password and send an email to your email account. So you want to make sure your email account, which is basically your online internet identity, is secured. And two-factor is the best way to do that. Mm-hmm. But coming back to the original question, right? How, what can we do to make yourself secure? Yeah. So, for example, in this telco breach, you could have done nothing. I know. Yeah, because it's not your fault, right? It's not your computer that was breached. You need to have a mobile phone, so you registered for one, and then your data was lost. What else could you have done, really? So I know a lot of guys who ask the question, what can we do? They expect some sort of, you know, silver bullet panacea sort of quest answer, you know, use this product or use that and do this. But actually, online security is, you know, just executing a bunch of very basic steps, which are simple to understand, but, you know, a lot of not so easy to do, especially in you guys. So even turning on two-factor, which I have for all my accounts, I'm guessing you or your guys I found it very troubling, because now you can't access your email just like that. You got to whip out your phone and do something and enter a six-digit code.
Yeah.
And that creates what we call, you know, the what the marketing guys call friction, right? There's a bit of friction there. Everybody wants a frictionless, seamless integration to this. Click a button and everything happens, and sort of thing. So security is always about a trade-off. You got to trade off something to get some security, whether that's money or convenience or something. And you just have to make some rational decisions about where you would like to have the trade-off and where you don't.
And so I guess just to close off this discussion, this website, Have I Been Pawned, has been around for a while for us to check whether or not our email accounts have been, either details of it has been breached or it's been used for other purposes. And are there any similar websites around that you would recommend us going to check to just, you know, for our email, or what else could it be? Our phone numbers?
No, so Have I Been Pawned only uses emails, and the guy who runs it is a great guy, Troy Hunt. Mm-hmm. He's got a blog and he's got a podcast. I recommend people listen to it or read it. And as far as I know, that's the best place to go. So if you want to just, you can actually, so you don't even have to go there and check. You can go there and check and you can subscribe so that the next time your email turns up in a breach somewhere, it automatically just sends you an email. You know, so you don't have to keep on going back every now and then to do it. So for checking breaches, that's the best site. As far as I know, that's the only site I recommend.
And
maybe there's more, but yeah.
Yeah. And if your email is compromised, the first thing is to change your password and put on two-factor.
Yes. So here's how it works. Right? So maybe it's what. So this is what criminals do when they breach a site. You know, so if I breach the site and I manage to get the entire database of usernames and passwords. So first of all, if I breach the site, I have access to the site. So what for would I want to log on as somebody else? But what people do is that they breach some, you know, random forum somewhere that nobody cares about. They get a bunch of username and passwords, and then they retry those username and passwords in other more important sites. So if you're reusing your password from, you know, the Korean drama forum that you have to also buy stuff from Lazada or to log on to your Maybank to you account, that's a problem, because the moment that forum gets breached and people start using those username and passwords, the first thing they do is they just start reusing them across many different services,
right?
So this is why you shouldn't reuse a password between sites ever.
Passwords are not encrypted on those servers? Like they are able to read it?
Yeah, so the general good practice way of doing it is you hash a password. A hash is a one-way mathematical function that basically can only be done one way, right? So you take a password, you hash it. But there are sort of ways that we can just guess passwords. So if I have a hash of your password, I can start guessing your password. And with a powerful enough machine, and if you have a weak enough password, I can sort of know it already. Now, that also doesn't mean that who knows that that little anime forum that you visited actually hashed the password. Maybe they're storing it in plain text. Mm. So if you reuse your password across all services, you know, the thing about the chain is only as strong as its weakest link. You know, all it takes is for one of those sites to get breached, and then all of your sites get breached because you use the same username and password across all of them. Mm. So it's important to use a unique username and password, and not just, you know, append upon the site name at the end of a random string of passwords, but actually you use really unique strings of passwords across all your accounts so that you don't get a victim of this. This is very common. The other thing that's the saving grace, though, is that even if you reuse your password, if you had two-factor authentication, then that's at least another blocker. Because even if I'm using a password, I log on to the site, and then when it asks me for the two-factor, for the second factor, whether that's the six-digit code that you send via SMS or the six-digit code that you get from the phone, you know, I don't have it. Yeah. And the way it works is that it's all about scale, right? So if a hacker breached 10 million accounts, why would I bother with your one account that has second factor? I'll just move on to the next one, then the next one, till I get some access. Mm. So turning on two-factor, very important. If that's the one thing you do, just do that.
So have I Been Pwned the website work the same way as Cygan Hack? And if it does, how come they are able to still go on running while Cygan Hack couldn't?
The one key difference, of course, Troy Hunt's much better than me. He's a real security professional. And Have I Been Pwned has like 4.5 billion records or some, you know, 11 billion records or whatever it is. The one real difference is that the key, the thing that you're searching for on Have I Been Pwned is an email address. Mm-hmm. The thing that you search for on Cygan Hack, you know, have you heard of this website, Cygan Hack, is your IC number. And that's maybe that's a little bit more sensitive. It is definitely more sensitive than an email address, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Any final words on what, I guess, you've learned or what you've gathered from this whole experience?
I guess...
Should we change the way we live or go about our digital life?
Nah, man. You just live... It's a minor miracle that the internet works at all. And as much as we talk about cybercrime and all of these breaches and that, I think in general, cybercrime is still a very, very small percentage of the economy. So, you know, retail shrinkage, for example, is much, much higher than cybercrime. So we cybercrime's at a controllable level. So we shouldn't lose our minds over it. The thing that I learned, I guess, not really learned, but there was a lot of good reporting around this, which is good. You know, tech journalism, for example, the word tech differentiates it from, you know, sports journalism or, you know, political journalism. But the key sort of the skill set is still journalism. And, you know, I met a bunch of really good journalists out there who know how to write their stuff and who know how to tell the story and craft it and go about the interviews, you know, more than I can do with my blog. So that was really eye-opening for me. Yeah.
And explaining it in a term where I can, people like me who is not tech-trained can understand, right?
Yeah, I guess, So, the stuff that I read and the stuff that, well, say normal people know, it's completely different, right? So it's important that we have people who can, I won't say dumb down, but importantly, we have people to craft the story so that the audience understands it. And that is a very important skill in today's world. Some of the journalism was very sensationalist. Some of the journalism was very bad. But I think in general was really good. You know, shout out to the guys from The Star, even BFM. I think 2 weeks ago you guys interviewed, or 1 week ago you guys interviewed Fong Qing Long. Really good interview. And even, you know, some other websites, the other.my as well. So there were great stuff. And then I think in general, although there were a lot of people who were against it, in general, I guess the Malaysian public was quite supportive of it. So thanks for that.
Yeah. All right, Keith, thank you so much for your time.
No worries.
I've been speaking to tech blogger Keith Rosario, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.